As we resume today our study in Ruth, and we will dismiss in just a second, if you think about where we are biblically, we are in the historical books of the life of the nation of Israel. We are moving toward the cross. Thank you for that wonderful, wonderful song this morning to draw our hearts toward the cross. We're going to look at steps taken toward the cross as we're pointed in that direction in this last chapter in the book of Ruth. We'll dismiss now for Discovery Club. And I trust that Jen has found a replacement for me in the threes and fours, because I told her if she hadn't, to give me the high sign and I would walk out of here and go in there, and somebody could choose to either come up here or go back there. So it looks like it's worked out. Thank you, whoever did it. Not long ago, I picked up the Living Bible paraphrase. I was looking for something, and I had not looked or read from the Living Bible in a long time. But I was curious about how it might paraphrase something I was reading. So I looked to where it was on the shelf. There was one there, that green leather-bound cover. I remembered it well, and I pulled it off the shelf and opened it. That version of the Living Bible was one that Patty and I had given to my grandmother, my dad's mother. We called her Gran, for Christmas in 1972. It's a long way back. 1972. When she passed away, the family gave that back to us to have that Bible that she had had. But as I opened it recently, there were some things in it that if I'd known and knowing years ago they were there. She died in about 84 or so, maybe 86, somewhere in there. I had forgotten them. And one was a sheet of blue paper with handwriting. I could recognize her hand easily. She'd written with a pencil. And she had written down some scriptural references, often tied them to the page number in the Living Bible. So it was of interest to me to see what she had decided to make note of. One of the notes directed me to Psalm 12. In fact, when I opened to Psalm 12, she had drawn a line right at the top of Psalm 12. Listen to how that psalm, it's a psalm of lament that David wrote, but listen to how it begins in the Living Bible. It says, "Lord, help. Godly men are fast disappearing. Where in all the world can dependable men be found? Everyone deceives and flatters and lies. There is no sincerity left." Talk about things not changing. Psalm 12, David writing, where are dependable, godly men in this life? I believe I know why my grandmother picked that passage. My grandmother was a close follower of politics. She read the local newspaper from cover to cover. She observed the national stories and the local. And I knew that back in those days, she would speak frequently that we didn't have men that she called statesmen, men of integrity, men who would be willing to put the good of the nation ahead of personal agendas. She worried about the trend in our country toward men who lacked integrity. That was a time when we were experiencing some of that, if you remember. And she points to Psalm 12, and it raises that excellent question, Where do we look to find godly men? Well, as we finish our study in Ruth today and examine that last chapter, Ruth 4, you'll see that the focus of the narrative, the focus of the account today, is on a man by the name of Boaz, and we've gotten to know him. We've seen he's a godly man. As we begin to get to know him better today, we'll see his integrity, his character further demonstrated. If you remember where we are in Ruth, in Ruth 3, Ruth asked Boaz in the dark of night at the threshing floor to marry her. A very bold move that she made that night. And Boaz was thrilled. He wanted to marry Ruth. I had said earlier in a study back in 2 that the great difference in their age, and there apparently was, and said something about he may not have been particularly attracted to her, and Neil Smith said afterwards, I believe she was good looking, and he was very much attracted to her. But for whatever reason, and I think the quality of her heart is what spoke loudest to Boaz, but he wanted to marry Ruth. Yet, as much as that was his desire, we'll still see that he held that today with an open hand. Boaz cared more about doing things right than he did about getting what he wanted. He wanted to do the right thing the right way in connection with marrying Ruth. And that process meant he had to recognize the right of another man that was superior to his. So you talk about holding this. When this woman comes to you and says, "Will you marry me?" Oh, did he want to marry her? But now he has to hold that with an open hand because he recognizes that there's a right that is superior to his. Let's see how this narrative unfolds. Open in your text, if you will, to the first part of chapter 4. I think it sort of lays out in steps. And this first step involves some land that was for sale. That's a new thing for us here in Ruth. Let's see what our author tells us about it. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, "Turn aside, friend. Sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. He took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Now remember, the night before, Boaz had said he would address the situation the next day. Ruth went home to Naomi, and Naomi said, "Sit back. He'll do it." And boy, he did. The next morning, he's at the gate. He knew where to position himself in the city. It would be like knowing that the people you wanted to see gathered in the morning at Cracker Barrel for coffee, and you went there. He knew the significant place to be. That was the gate of the city. People passed through the gate in and out of the city. Commerce took place there. The elders of the city gathered there. And it did not take long before this close relative passed by. We've looked before at photos of a city gate back in earlier studies in Judges or perhaps Joshua. But they were rooms at the entrance to the city. Put one up before you just to remind you of what that looked like there, if we can get to that slide. There it is. Now imagine these walls, they weren't this short. This is the excavation and what's left when the excavation occurs. But you can see the rooms that existed here. They're not large rooms, but they are rooms along both sides at the city gate, which was at the entrance of the city. Keep the size of those rooms in mind as we get to the end of the narrative because it's rather interesting. But Boaz was where he wanted to be, and he asked this relative to sit for a while, and he got the 10 elders of the city who would witness what occurred. And some have said it's much like a court proceeding here. Boaz needed the presence of the elders to confirm and attest to what happened there that day. Let's go on and see the exchange. Verse 3. Then he said to the closest relative, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Well, this is the first time in these two verses that we hear Naomi has some interest in land. It's relatively interesting because it was Elimelech's land that she has an interest in. And we haven't heard anything about that so far in our narrative. Let's talk about what that interest was. Verse 3 in a New American Standard says that she had to sell the land. Now, farmland was not something that Naomi and Ruth could handle or work. If it had been, Ruth would never have gone to glean in the fields as she did when she met Naomi just to get grain for bread to live on. As we look back at passages in Numbers and Deuteronomy that deal with who inherits land when the husband dies, there's no indication that as Elimelech's wife, Naomi would have inherited his land. So I don't think she was selling the land outright, but our text makes it clear that she had an interest in the land. In studying this, most commentators seem to think it's something called a usufruct interest. Can you repeat that? 25-cent word, usufruct, which means really the use of. In our day and time, if I conveyed to Chris a piece of property and reserved a life estate, legally that would mean that he gets it after I have the right to use it for my life. On my death, it would go to him. That would be a right to use, a usufruct, that I would be retaining. It's thought here that that may have been what she had, is a right to use during her lifetime. And it's not been mentioned in the discussions of Naomi previously, but obviously Boaz knew of it. He didn't mention it to Ruth the night before, but he knew that the key to marrying Ruth would be to deal with it in accordance with the levirate custom, which was to begin with redeeming Naomi's interest in the land. Boaz made sure that this closer relative knew what his rights were as a man in that position. And Boaz let him know that he was in line after that man if the relative did not want to purchase the land. But what did we see at the end of verse 4? As soon as Boaz lays it out, that guy says, you got a deal. I'll buy it. He wants the land. Some speculate as to whether at the gate, and we're going to see a crowd had gathered in addition to the elders, was Ruth there? Was Naomi there? Boy, if they had been, can you imagine how your heart would sink into your stomach and the whole thing flip over when that guy says, I'll take it. I got it. I'll redeem it. We don't know. That's just some interesting speculation. But this man did not hesitate. But there's yet another step. The first step, we know the land is available and he wants to buy it. But now the second step, the rest of the deal. Verse 5. Look at your text. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. Boaz, I think, wisely put the land first. I read some people that think he was manipulating a bit. I think it was an act of faith. The land is what drew this man. If he really wanted the land, he would take Ruth. If he really wanted it. Boaz has got his hand, I think, wide open and laid out there to see how this works out, to see, if you will, what the Lord does. But now as Boaz gives the rest of the contract, things begin to change here. Boaz says, as part of receiving the land, you've also got to take Ruth. And he mentions she's from Moab. She's the widow of the deceased, not Elimelech, we know. We'll see in a minute. She's the widow of Mahlon, one of the sons of Elimelech. So you can raise up the name of his son on his inheritance. So what's that mean? Well, that means you'll take Ruth as your wife so that there can be a son, hopefully, who receives the inheritance. This is not the technical aspect of the levirate marriage that we saw in Deuteronomy 25, because we know Mahlon did not have any surviving brothers. So this man is not in that spot. But levirate marriage was something that preexisted the law. The law came before this, and though it's not technically binding here, the custom, evidently, is still very clear. And the spirit of the law would be, if you're going to take the land, then you need to also acquire Ruth as your wife so somebody can be raised up to keep this land in the family. Some scholars have written that maybe this closest relative knew of Naomi and thought, well, with the land will come Naomi, but Naomi's past childbearing, and Naomi's older, and so there's not much risk there. I can take care of Naomi. But to put Ruth in the mix, as Boaz said needed to be done, really changed the dynamic for him. And Ruth would be a young woman who could still have children, and who would be entitled to support for many, many years. If you remember, all Naomi wanted right now was that Ruth's future be secured. And when you look at the approach Boaz took, I really like it, because he's saying, if the closest relative takes the land and takes Ruth, he'll have Ruth and Naomi, and he'll support them from then on. And hopefully there'll be an heir who's raised up out of his union with Ruth. He's trying to be sure they're provided for one way or the other if this goes through. I think when he made that last statement, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, it may have been the most important statement he made in all of this, though it's easy to sort of run by that. Because when we step back and look at Ruth, the line of Elimelech is extremely important, because this whole account is how God is bringing the line from Judah all the way to David. It's not going to come through. We know God's will is not for this man to marry Ruth. It's going to come through Boaz. But Boaz is picking up on the importance of an heir here. Now let's see the response of this closest relative in verse 6. Once he hears and has heard the whole deal. The closest relative, and you know he's never named. He's never named. The author just, it's hard to tell whether you just sort of punted, guy, so I'm not even going to give you the dignity of using your name. Who knows? But he said, I cannot redeem it for myself. Oh, he can't now. Because I would jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. I think this closest relative, once he heard of Ruth's involvement, was quickly running the numbers, if you will, and going, uh-oh. If Ruth is involved and I marry Ruth and we have a son, then not only will I lose the property I'm just now buying because it will go to the son in inheritance, but then that child will have the right to inherit the rest of my property as a son. So I think that's what he means when he says this will jeopardize, in our parlance today, this would jeopardize my estate plan. I've laid this out. I've already got three sons. I'm planning on they're getting this property. What happens if I have more children and more heirs, and then that's all of a sudden not what it looked like today? He wanted no part of it once he realized what he had could be diminished if he were to marry Ruth. So we know it wasn't God's will, but Boaz didn't. And Boaz is walking through these particular events, I would suggest to you, very much by faith. He's doing what he believes is the right thing to do. And this man says, the door's open, Boaz. I just can't do it. It's yours to redeem. Now let's look at verse 7. This was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption and the exchange of land to confirm any matter. A man removed his sandal and gave it to another. And this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So the closest relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. And he removed his sandal. This is the only time in the Hebrew scriptures this appears. So we don't know much about it. But apparently our author, writing when he did, felt it necessary to describe for us what the practice was of conveying land at that time. You take your sandal. Take your sandal. Maybe that symbolized walking on the land. I walk on that I own. And I give this to you because you've just acquired the right to buy it. You now have the right to that land. That's what he did with Boaz. How wise it was for Boaz to have gathered at the gate, to have brought the elders there to witness what happened, and to attest to the transactions that took place when Boaz knew not how that would all unfold. So step two, when the rest of the deal was known, things changed and the door swung wide open for Boaz. Let's look at the third step that is in verses 9 through 12. We have a new buyer, a new husband, and a promise kept. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Moreover, I have acquired Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that the name of the deceased will not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today. so that the name of the deceased would not be cut off. Boaz is now able to do what Ruth asked him to do the night before. He's able to do it with the security of knowing he's handled it correctly. He's done it the right way. And now he gets not only the land, which just helps certainly Naomi, whom he cares about, but he gets Ruth as his wife and the privilege of raising up an heir. And the people responded. Look at verse 11. All the people who were in the court and the elders said, now let me stop there. Remember those small rooms. Just let your mind's eye think about that. This is where commerce takes place. If you're coming and going out of Bethlehem, you're going through the city gate. So you're coming along and somebody says, hey, you know what's going on in there? The elders are meeting with Boaz and Ruth, the Moabitess. It's pretty interesting. We're going to see who acquires her today. I think there were people gathered, knowing how we are as people. We're walking by. There's something interesting going on. Oh, yeah, let's see. Let's see. Let's watch. And all the people who are in the court and the elders, then they're all in this saying, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman. How neat that the witnesses here immediately turn to the Lord and ask the Lord's blessing on Ruth. We've just finished, and this occurred during the time of Judges, a dark time in the land of Israel. Every man doing what was right in his own eyes. And in the midst of this, we have this little moment of oasis where we see these events unfolding and the people say, may the Lord, Yahweh, make Ruth, they don't name her by name, that's clearly who it is, who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah. Now, who were Rachel and Leah? You remember? Daughters of Laban, wives of Jacob, mothers of those who became the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, I think they're saying, Lord, we pray you may bless this woman and grant her offspring, just like you did with Rachel and Leah. And they pray that Boaz may achieve wealth in Ephrathah. We know that's within Bethlehem. I would say with the wealth, they're probably talking about children. It puts in mind for me the great language of Psalm 127. We use it frequently here, but remember these words. Verse 1 begins this way. Unless the Lord builds the house, which is what they're asking for, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord build the house, may the Lord build this house and grant you children out of this marriage. Let me ask, who is building your home? Who is building your house? Is God a piece of what you are building? Or are you a piece of what God is doing? Is he just a part of what you're building? Or are you a part of what he is constructing? I hope it's the latter for us. Do you desire a posterity through children and grandchildren that is significant unto the Lord. That only happens if He builds our homes. We use frequently, too, the third, fourth, and fifth verses of that same psalm, which reads, "Behold, children are a gift from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They shall not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate." I think that's the kind of wealth they desired for Boaz. They asked the Lord to please open the womb of Ruth. You stop and think for a second. Ruth was probably married to Malon for maybe close 10 years. No children. No heirs. No kids. These ladies came in, or these people came in and prayed, "Lord, would you please grant her the ability to have children?" And they asked that Boaz would also be famous in Bethlehem. We hear those words and it's like his name will be, his face will be on a billboard somewhere or in a commercial. And that's not at all what's being spoken of here. Famous is a translation of a Hebrew idiom that literally means to call a name. They wanted his name to be called out throughout Bethlehem. They wanted Boaz to be well known because Boaz was a godly man worthy of emulation. Where are the godly men? There weren't many in Judges, but in the period of Judges, there arose a man by the name of Boaz, and they prayed that his name would be called out in Bethlehem in the days ahead. And they prayed that the house of Boaz would be like that of Perez, the son of Judah, and Tamar. That's an interesting account. If you haven't read it in a while, it's back in Genesis 38. Tamar was married to Ur. Ur was the firstborn of Judah. Just get the significance here. Judah's firstborn. Ur turned out to be a very evil man. And Genesis 38 tells us that God took his life. God wiped him out because of the way he was. So Judah then turned to Onan, Ur's brother, and said, "You need to fulfill your duty to Tamar." And Onan failed to do that. He didn't want to dilute his inheritance, much the same as our close relative. And Judah then told his daughter-in-law to remain a widow until my youngest son is of age, and you can be his wife. Well, she went to live then in her father's house. There's thought that she was probably Canaanite, and nothing happened. Years went by. And she learned one day that Judah was coming to shear sheep. So she had a scheme. She met him on the way and she posed as a prostitute. She had her face covered and she was dressed so he would not recognize her. His wife had recently died and Judah went into her, his daughter-in-law, not knowing who she was. Well, while they were together, she said to him, "I would really like to have some of your possessions, some of the things you have with you." And he gave them to her, and she left with them. And out of that union were born to her twins, the older of whom was Perez. If you know the story, once Judah heard that his daughter-in-law was pregnant, of all things, she was expecting. He ordered her brought to him and burned. So Tamar came, with the things that were Judah's and stood before him and said, the father of who I'm carrying is the man who owns these things. That stopped the process. Perez was born. The one thing these two different events have in common is that levirate marriage. In the first case, it did not go well at all, and that was before the law came. The second case, in Ruth's case, it came after the law, but wasn't a specific application. But you look at the two women and how differently they handled the situation. One, through deceit and manipulation, had children. The other acted completely honorably and walked it out by faith. But you know what? Both women are in the line of Messiah. Both women are in the line of Messiah. Tamar, who was deceitful, maybe a Canaanite. Ruth from Moab. Moab, Deuteronomy 23 tells us that descendants of Moab cannot be in the assembly of Israel because of how wicked they were toward Israel. God's judgment on them, they can't be in the assembly. How is it then that in the plan of God, when this woman says, and your God shall be my God, and your people shall be my people, and makes that great confession of her own faith in the Yahweh of Israel, God receives her. And not only does he receive her, but he gives her a position in the line of the coming Messiah, his son. Whew. There's a lot taking place here, isn't there? Now we come down to the fourth step in all this, the blessing of God. Verse 13, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her. And the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. We start every baby dedication here with the recognition that children are a gift from the Lord. Those are not mere words. We have children because God has allowed us the privilege to do so. A son was born to Boaz and Ruth. Verse 14, then the women said to Naomi, this is what, 9 months after they marry, or at least 9 months or more. Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today. They're talking to Naomi, remember? Blessed is the Lord, Naomi, who's not left you without a redeemer today, and may his name become famous, be called out in Israel. So who's the redeemer? Who is the redeemer for Naomi? It's not Boaz. It's the son of Boaz. He is the one who will be there to provide long-term for the care and the protection and the life of Naomi. May his name be famous in Israel. Verse 15. May he also be to you a restorer of life and a sustainer of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you is better to you than seven sons. She has given birth to him. Wow. At the core of God's provision for Naomi was Ruth. It was indeed a privilege in Israel to have a son. Indeed a privilege. And these women look at Naomi and say, Naomi, to have a daughter-in-law like Ruth is better for you than seven sons. And that's probably a sense of ultimate fulfillment. If you had had 7 boys. Wow. But I'm telling you, this woman is better to you than 7 sons. Naomi, you remember when we started, Ruth suffered great tragedy. I mean, it will suck the air out of your lungs to think, my husband died, and then both my boys, my only 2 children. The air was sucked completely out of her. She became bitter. She saw God as her adversary in all of that. He had done this to her. She came back. She left Pleasant. She came back bitter. Don't call me Naomi Pleasant anymore, for I am bitter. Call me Mara. How interesting. Her life was never empty. It only felt empty. And life does at times feel incredibly empty, doesn't it? Hers was never empty because God had already begun to provide for her in the depth of her despair because he had given her Ruth. She just didn't know how that would unfold. Now look at verse 16. You'll love this because you can picture it. Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. What a high moment. She's lost a husband and 2 sons, and now she has this boy. The neighbor women gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Some writers say, well, this was really her son. That means she must have adopted Obed at that time. I think not. This is the son of Ruth and Boaz, but his nanny is Naomi. She's like his grandmother. And she takes him in, and what a privilege for her at this point in life to be able to care for him. And the women get involved in naming the child. That probably doesn't mean that Ruth and Boaz were completely excluded, but they came up with the name Obed, which means to serve. And Obed, we know, became the father of Jesse, who was the father of David. The significance of Obed is not in what is recorded about his life, what he did, or how he served. Daniel Block well writes of the real significance of Obed. Look with me at this quote that should be on the screen. The birth of Obed has historical significance because he lives on and achieves his significance through the lives of his son Jesse, and particularly his grandson David. Through David, the blessing of the male witnesses to the court proceeding in 4:11 is fulfilled. Boaz's name is called out in Bethlehem. And through David, the prayer of the female witnesses to the birth of Obed is fulfilled. Obed's name is called out in Israel. Indeed, to this day, their names and the names of Naomi and Ruth are called out all over the world as the story is read. Famous in the sense of being called out and recognized because they're in the line of Jesus. The very end of Ruth, I think, is critically important because it gives us what I think is the primary purpose we have this historical account in Ruth. It establishes the messianic link from David back to Perez, who's the son of Judah, the son of Abraham. Now think with me for a moment what God is doing. Let's back up for just a second and look quickly at the forest. We've been in the trees. Let's look at the forest. Remember Genesis 3:15, the proto-evangelium, where God declares, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, God says to Satan, and you shall bruise him on the heel. The first gospel, as it said, the first indication of the coming of Messiah. And then there's God's words to Abraham, where God says, I will make you, Abraham, a great nation and bless you and make your name great. And you'll be a blessing. Blessing is going to come through Abraham. All the families of the earth, God said, are going to be blessed through the family of this one man. Back, looking at the forest, the promise, first promise, not much said, but first promise of Messiah. God's selection of a man through whom the ultimate blessing would come. So Jesus has to be a descendant of Abraham. How would that happen? When Genesis 17, in the covenant with Abraham, God says, my covenant is with you. You shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I will make you a father of the multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings, underline, kings shall come forth from you. You know, that promise was made. That promise was made when he had no son. Oh, really? Oh, we sit back now and say, oh, yeah, well, sure. Abraham just had to believe because God is faithful to his promise. But what happens to us when we're trying to count on the promise of God and there's nothing around us that indicates God is working? Whew. But God's word is true. He made that promise. We know Isaac came, and Jacob and Esau, and out of Jacob, the 12 sons, and we've touched on that, and one of those sons was Judah, and as Jacob was dying, and going over each son and blessing them, you remember prophetically what he said in Genesis 49:10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. That's speaking of Messiah. Out of the line of Judah, the king will rule. God then has to bring that about through unlikely characters, through imperfect people. And we see at the end of Ruth this genealogy. We know about Judah. We know about Perez. Now, these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron. To Hezron was born Ram. And to Ram, Amminadab. And to Amminadab was born Nashon, and to Nashon, Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz, Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse, David. See the forest, God's promise, as it unfolds, and now in the lives of Ruth and Boaz, the privilege of coming together in this unlikely union that God brings about, and bearing a son who's in the line of David, in the line of Christ. Ruth is such a fantastic account of how God works through circumstances that seem futile, that can be absolutely immersed in pain and despair. But we see God working through those in his time, in His way to accomplish His purposes. He brings blessing when it looks like there's no potential for that. In the midst of Naomi's darkest time, Ruth stood alongside. And that was just the beginning of what God was going to do. Not because Naomi deserved it, but because God intended to use her and her family in a very significant way. Ruth tells us that there is nothing impossible with God, and He will fulfill His purposes. You think of that with Gabriel as he came to Mary and said, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and you will bear a son." And she is bewildered, as anyone would have been in her spot. How can this be? Gabriel's words, with God, nothing is impossible. How we need to be reminded of His message. Even when there's no way to see through our eyes how He's working, we can be confident He is. He never leaves us. He never forsakes us. He will accomplish His purposes in our lives. You have purpose in His eyes. He's created you for His purposes, to fulfill what He has for you, just as He created Naomi and Ruth and Boaz. We need to be reminded that though emptiness can come, God's fullness is always there when we keep walking by faith, trusting Him. He always, we've been working on this in Cubbies, He always, always keeps His promises. They're true. Trials and difficulties come, and they do, and they will continue. But we need to rest in the knowledge and the truth of His faithfulness. Let's pray. Father, how fortunate we are to have in Your Word, in Your text, the inspired story of Naomi and Ruth and Boaz and now Obed. How You worked miraculously, consistently, faithfully, never abandoning those who were Yours, Father. Though at times they felt like You had completely left them. Thank You, Father, for what great truths this calls up about You for us. Help us, Father, at any age, at every age and stage sitting here, from young to old, to realize how true Your Word is and how faithful You are. May that truth, Father, help change our lives for Jesus' sake.